UK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Christopher Cruz in the Washington Bureau. The unsealed indictment enumerating the 37 federal criminal counts against Donald Trump shows prosecutors believe the former president's actions endangered national security. CBS's Catherine Herridge reports the 49-page indictment is breathtaking in its scope and devastating in its detail.
The criminal charges grew out of a 14-month investigation. Prosecutors say over 100 documents marked classified were recovered during an FBI search of Mar-a-Lago. Prosecutors say they have an audio recording of Trump where he apparently acknowledges he has classified information. CBS News has learned that in the recording, he describes a Pentagon memo about Iran that includes secret and highly confidential information.
CBS's Robert Costa says Trump's so-called body man, Walt Nauta, has been indicted along with Trump.
He was a personal aide to the former president after he left the White House, and he is someone, per the indictment, who took Trump's direction at almost every turn about moving documents from the White House around the property, sometimes moving them, it seems, to New Jersey when Trump went up to Bedminster. He is an accomplice in every way.
CBS's Scott McFarland says Trump has been summoned to appear at a federal court in Miami on Tuesday.
An initial appearance happens at 3 p.m. He has to be there for that. There is likely to be an arraignment immediately after. He'll plead guilty or not guilty. They'll talk about release conditions. It could take just minutes, and we always underscore this. No cameras in the courthouse. No booking photos released by the feds, and it's possible he's brought through a private entrance. This all might be invisible on Tuesday.
Yoram van der Sloot, the prime suspect in the 2005 disappearance of Alabama teenager Natalie Holloway in Aruba, pleaded not guilty today in Birmingham to extortion and fraud charges. Carol Standifer is a friend of Beth Holloway, Natalie's mother.
We were just really happy that this day has happened, and Beth has worked so hard for years to get him on the soil in Alabama and to get him in a position where he can, you know, we can find some justice for what happened to Natalie.
Van der Sloot was flown to the U.S. yesterday from Peru, where he was serving a 28-year sentence for killing a 21-year-old woman. The cleanup continues after the breach of a vital dam in southern Ukraine.
Evidence is mounting that the breach of the Novokarkovka Dam on Tuesday was due to an explosion. Today, scientists in Norway said seismological data suggest an explosion occurred just before the dam was destroyed. Ukraine has accused Russia of blowing up the dam near the front lines of its war with Russia. Russia, in turn, blames Ukraine.
CBS's Elaine Cobb. This is CBS News.
Need hires who dazzle without the hassle? You need Indeed. Their powerful platform helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Continue the conversation online. Find and follow Civic Media on Facebook and on Twitter.
For Civic Media News, I'm Stuart J. Waddles. Here's what you need to know in Southeast Wisconsin. Under the new shared revenue plan announced yesterday, the city and county of Milwaukee can increase sales taxes with a two-thirds vote from the city council or county board. The tax could be up to 2% in the city, 0.4% for the county. It could be September before those changes are passed. Joshua Daniel Jr., the 18-year-old charged with shooting and killing a Racine Horlick basketball player in May of 2021, has now claimed it was an act of self-defense. That's according to his lawyer in a recent court appearance. There's no lack of pastry in Racine, but one longtime kitchen is closing. Pete Schwaba has more.
Larson Bakery, a renowned Racine Kringle company, has ceased its operations after more than 60 years. The bakery, under the ownership of the same individuals since 1969 and opened in 1960, decided to close its kitchen this week.
For Civic Media News, I'm Stuart J. Waddles.
It's time you checked out Champions Pub on Milwaukee's East Side, a classic Milwaukee tavern since 1956. Champions is a comfortable place to gather and enjoy a drink over a game of shuffleboard, cribbage, bags, golden tea, or just relax in its sunny beer garden or covered deck. Champions Pub has something for everyone. It's a great place to escape the usual bar crowds and hide out for drinks and conversation. Stop by Champions Pub and enjoy its good service and low-key neighborhood atmosphere.
Knucklehead CBD and Vapes is now online at knuckleheads.shop. Step into your favorite smoke shop without leaving your home. Find grinders, papers, Delta 8, and more, all from your computer or phone. With free shipping on all orders over $50, you'll be sure to find exactly what you like. You can also order for in-store pickup, so there's no wait. Knucklehead CBD and Vapes, located at 520 State Street in Madison. Order online today at knuckleheads.shop. With free shipping on all orders over $50, you'll be sure to find exactly what you like.
The Todd Alba Show.
We'll be moving to the afternoon, Monday through Friday, 1 until 3. Trigby Olson has graciously agreed to follow us into the afternoon. We're going to get to talk about the Lincoln Project and politics in Wisconsin, all across the state of Wisconsin.
I know, isn't that exciting? Where the beer is cold, the cheese curds are squeaky, the Harleys roar, the Eagles soar, and the Packers score, Todd.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on your local Civic Media Radio station and on the app.
Boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Back here in Burlington, Iowa, sitting here at the UAW Hall, Local 807. And thanks to the good folks here at 807 giving us the opportunity to come into their hall, speak with some members, some of their leadership folks, and talk about the strike at Case New Holland. And, you know, again, you know, one of the things we keep coming back to, nobody wants to be on strike. It's always the last arrow in the quiver. And sometimes you just have to do it. And here to share some thoughts about why in this moment, why at the end of the pandemic, when you know the workers were essential and patriotic frontline heroes, the companies forced their hand and forced them into this situation. That's why I've asked Tracy Chu to come sit down with us. Tracy is the bargaining committee woman here for the Case New Holland strike. She's also the recording secretary at UAW Local 807, the women's committee chair here and also across the region, and I'm sure she's going to get to that. Tracy, thanks for taking time for us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
So let's start why we're here. It seems ridiculous in this moment, given the fact that we just came out of the pandemic and you guys were heaped with praise. Oh, you were frontline heroes, patriotic, yeah. You know, all of this stuff. The company is wildly profitable, enormously profitable, especially with all the inflation going on. And yet here you are.
That's right. Our worth during the pandemic, of course, when we had some essential people there that had to work, the agricultural department had to work. I typically work in the backhoe department. So we were put out they didn't really utilize the COVID word, but we were laid off due to part shortages. So some of us weren't as essential as the others. So, I think our worth, we're worth more now. Our value has went up. Skilled labor has went up. Knowing what you're building and trying to tap into those profit margins with such a huge, like you said, conglomerate of a company who is just, it's just not a good time for us, for sure.
No, but here's the thing. I was looking at some of the profit numbers. This company's wildly profitable.
Ridiculous, man. Absolutely.
Wildly profitable.
It's insane.
It seems, you know, if I'm talking to the shareholders, sure. It seems to me to be corporate malpractice at a time when you're making such enormous profits to jeopardize that by saying we're not going to have our best skilled people making the best product in the world anymore. No, we're going to bring in some scabs and some reserve people and maybe a supervisor who knows where the machine is, let alone knows how to use it. That's the product we're going to be putting out to our customers.
Sure.
It seems like corporate malpractice. And if I'm talking to the shareholders, I'm telling them this is what you're investing in.
Yes. Yep, that's exactly it. Skilled labor is very important right now. And it seems like moving forward, it's going to be tough going back into that situation because these people basically came for our livelihoods, right? So, you know, pre-strike, we were told that we were trying to be number one. Our quality initiatives that the union was putting in place to make sure we're putting out a good quality product, they were hyping us up like we were going to be number one. And we fed into that stuff, right? And the teamwork and the extra effort that you put in, only to find out that they really just don't give a darn at the end of the day. You know, when the clock struck noon, we were all walking out, but we were walking out proudly, you know, at that point, because, you know, we are essential. We know that we can build the best product, and for them not to care, that was just a stab in the back for sure.
So what's the sticking point? I mean, is it wages? Is it, you know, because I've talked to people who've gone on strike over the last several years, and it comes down to a couple of things. It's sometimes it's wages, but most of the times it's family life work balance.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's the idea that I don't want to work, you know, 365 days, 12 hours a day. I would like to see my kids' baseball games. So what was it? Healthcare? Was it pensions? Was it life work balance? Wages? What seems to be the sticking point?
You know, it was all of those things. We of course would like to be able to have times with our family, but you know, and the wages, of course, we all think that because we're building, you know, hundreds and thousands of dollars worth of equipment, that we should get, you know, we should be compensated for that. The labor, the intensive things that we do, like for an instance, I build pilot controls. Well, the amount of work content that goes into one pilot control, it's like a 2.5 hour process to build one pilot control for one backhoe. Can you imagine all the bits and pieces and parts that it takes to do that? So trying to teach, like you said, the scab workers to do that, probably weren't able to do such. So the work instructions were screwed up. I mean, so they weren't able to meet that goal, I'm sure, because of that.
I'll tell you, I wouldn't want to be the guy buying whatever's coming out of that plant right now.
Seriously.
But here's the thing, and this is where people are going to say, well, you get paid well. No, the reality is you guys create an enormous amount of profit.
Absolutely.
And I say this all the time. I want the company that I work for to be enormously profitable so that in these moments when we sit down and we negotiate, that we get some of the working class people get some of the wealth that their labor, their blood, sweat, and tears creates. It's not because we deserve it. It's because we earned it.
That's correct. Yes,
and this is where we need to be focusing our attention.
Absolutely.
More.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm over the hill a little bit now. I'm over 50.
Oh, I wouldn't.
I've got.
Come on. I thought you were in your 20s.
I do. So my husband and I both work there. My daughter also works there and her boyfriend as well. So it's engulfed my entire family with, you know, wondering about what's going to happen next. But being in the almost 10 years there and only making $20 an hour, I mean, that's disgraceful. It's absolutely disgraceful. It doesn't leave a lot of room for investments into your 401k for, I'm looking at retirement now in the next 17, probably be 20 years, you know, 70 would probably be the last time I'll be able to work. But I've still got a lot of good time in there, but I don't want to start over anywhere.
Right.
You know?
No, I get that. But ultimately, and this is where I keep coming back to it, I know my listeners are going to be going, well, you keep harping on the profits. This company is wildly profitable.
Absolutely.
The reality is they're spending lots of money enriching shareholders. They're doing all of the gimmicks that corporate America has been doing to line their pockets at the expense of folks like you.
Yep.
You create this product. A part of that should come to the working people. And this is what this is about, isn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely is.
Because nobody wants to be on strike. You didn't wake up at the beginning of this year.
Oh, my gosh,
no. Well, I sure hope we go on strike.
I was recently published in what the UAW has. It's called a Solidarity Magazine. And it's a full-page story of myself. And we talked about, you know, the importance of community relations and being out on strike and how, you know, it's completely changed the dynamics of one's personality, one's mental. I'm concerned, you know, when we go back, if we're going to be treated fairly, if we're going to be actually able to use our skills and go back to work like we did before, you know, trying to make the best product that we possibly can.
Now, you're listening to the Rick Smith Show with Tracy Chu. She's a bargaining committee woman here at the Chase New Holland strike, UAW 807. She's also a recording secretary and the first women's chair on that committee. She's the women's chairwoman, the chairwoman of the women's committee here at 807 and across the region. I do want to talk about that because community, you know, participation and community approval, if you will, is a huge part of this. That outreach is a huge part of it. So let's start there first. You know, what kind of response have you been getting from the community, and what kind of outreach have you been doing to them?
Well, we have, prior to the strike, we have established a strong community relations. The women's committee, typically, we do things with homeless shelters. We do things with foster children every Christmas. We sponsor a lot of outreach programs. In fact, this last week we did a coat drive that we're going to be distributing coats to the community on Tuesday. Having that strong community relations really helped the committee itself, the women's committee itself, because we already had those standing relationships with those people. So we knew who to reach out to. The importance of those standing committees during a strike situation in this case was imperative. So, you know, people know who I am out in the community. They know why I'm there. They know that I just want to help out. And we've kind of utilized that leverage to help our members with gas cards. We did a school supply drive. We purchased all the school supply all the school supplies for our local, as well as Racine, because Local 180 doesn't have a women's committee. So we actually drove up there with all these school supplies to Racine and provided all of their members with school supplies. But it's just basically utilizing what you have in the community to try to give back and make your members whole again.
No, and that's part of being a union member. That's part of being in a union. In fact, my producer and I were just having this conversation about your unions being somewhere that people belong to, be a community that people belong to, that in times of struggle, they help each other.
That's right.
And this is a perfect example of this. But, you know, the important part that you said there is even before the strike was happening, this is who you are. And this is what the labor movement has been doing for, you know, from the beginning of time almost.
Yes.
And get no recognition for it. And it's not like you're looking for recognition.
Absolutely not.
You know, I always point out that after Hurricane Katrina, we had one of the big superstores, you know, the one with the W. They donated like $18 million in water to disaster relief.
Bless their heart.
But spent $35 million promoting the fact that they gave $18 million. Union people don't do that. They do the work and don't look for the recognition. But I want to make sure that people know you do an awful lot of work in the community.
Yes, we do. We do. Absolutely. Kim Albers, she's in charge of the Strike Kitchen. She's also, as far as the community, you know, community projects is concerned, she makes sure that we get the food in the kitchen. We get bread from the community. We've got retirees that go to different agencies and get that free bread, bring that down to the Strike Kitchen. So it really takes a village, and having those good community networks in place prior to when you absolutely need them, like I said, it really helped us drive our members through this strike.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Tracy Chu. She's the bargaining committee woman, also the woman's committee chair, not just here at Local 807, but for the Southwest or the Southeast region, I guess it is. And this is you're kind of a big deal.
Yes, kind of.
Tell me what you do.
So not only, like I said, I'm at the Local 807 level, but I'm also Southeast Iowa chair. So we've got Champion, who's going to be coming up on a contract here shortly in the next few months. I'm also women's chair there. We mingle together and try to do things for the community together. I'm also the women's chair for John Deere and Ottumwa. So spend a lot of time with those gals just trying to get good community relations going. So we just kind of feed off each other, and we try to help each other grow. So Deere's been a big support for us, just like we'll be a big support for Champion, and then hopefully for Caterpillar. And moving forward, it's just it's a ripple effect.
It's that simple. It's that one word that I say every generation has to rediscover. Very simply, it's solidarity.
Absolutely. That's the key there. Absolutely.
It's people, working people, sticking together. And for me, Tracy, you know, we're a political talk show.
Yep.
Politically, we seem to be, you know, you bought the red hat, you bought the blue hat, mm-hmm. you know, whichever team you identify with. I keep saying that the way forward here is right here, right? In these union halls and in the workplaces, that's how we reunite, re-energize, re-engage this country and move us in a direction that makes people's lives better, working people's lives better. I say all the time, my true north is how we make working people's lives better.
But people don't understand that. Just we've got that union facility, and you know, we're looking for a better wage, we're looking for better health care, but what that's going to do to the community is it's going to make everybody else up their game just a tad bit, right? So, you know, Case will be the best place to go because we make X amount of dollars. You're going to have to put the work in, of course, because it's a difficult place to work. It's difficult work itself. But what it does to the community is it gives more dollars to spend within the community. It makes other companies have to, you know, react to the higher pay scales that we're given out. So, you know, it's the time to grow, man.
This is an excellent point. Communities
need to thank unions for their growth.
Absolutely. And this is an excellent point to make because, you know, I hear people say, well, you know, unions, they're just greedy.
I'm so sick of that.
And they
Absolutely.
Put companies out of business and they do all this stuff. And you go,
no.
They're bad for small business. No, unions, strong unions and communities are great for small businesses. Why? Because it puts disposable income into workers' pockets.
That's correct.
That then can go back into that local community. Look, the billions of dollars that this Case New Holland company is making off of your labor is not staying in this community.
That's correct.
It is going out of this community. It's going to Wall Street.
Yep.
We're basically screwing over Main Street so that Wall Street can get fat and happier. This is why every person should be supporting the work that you're
doing. Absolutely. You look at the graphs now. When people who are not in unions wish they were. I mean, we're back into the 80s sense again, back when unions were really strong back then. We're getting back to that. We're getting back to the core values of good skilled labor and a family and family time. When, you know, you talked about the quality of life and the 12-hour days. And let me just give you an example of how that hurts the family core, right? So we've got individuals, single mothers and whatnot. Daycares are typically not open for 13, 14 hours a day. So let's say you have to be at work at 6 a.m. A single mother has to be at work at 6 a.m. They have to drop their child off probably 5:30. They're not getting their child back from daycare till 7. It's against the law to have your kids in daycare more than 12 hours. So when we go talking about 12-hour days, it's not the matter of working them. It's just how do we work around those 12-hour days? I mean,
well, there shouldn't be. See, this is the thing that drives me crazy, Tracy. There shouldn't be 12-hour days.
Absolutely.
You know, over 100 years ago, we fought for the 8-hour
yes,
day.
Sir.
8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, eight
Say
hours
it, brother.
For
yes.
what we
yes.
will.
Yes.
The sad reality is we're giving up what we will or rest so that we can make these companies enormous amounts of profit.
Absolutely.
We should be fighting for that 8-hour day again.
Agreed.
And not just an 8-hour workday, but an 8-hour workday in what we were being forced to live on in 12.
Well, that's why I was hired to work. You know, at some point in time when I started at Case, I was only hired to work 8-hour days. You know, it has progressed over the years. Like I said, I've been there almost 10 years, and now it's 12-hour days.
So last question I've got for you. What
yes.
brings this back together? What gets you guys back to work? And what's the message for the CEO who I'm sure is going to be seeing some of the responses coming out of this? What's the message to get back?
Stay strong. Hold the line. Hold for what you believe in. We've been out almost 6 months. Solidarity is going to continue to get us through this. We really hope for a contract that we can live with for the next 3.5 years or so. We hope for, you know, some sort of security with a plant closing. If that would happen, we hope that more products get brought into Burlington so that we can employ more people, so that we can grow the business. We just want to go back to work. We want to go back to being successful people. We like working hard. We like the structure in our life, and we like building America. The question is, when are they going to allow us to do that again?
Yeah. You know? Excellent point, Tracy.
Thank you.
Chu, I appreciate you taking time for
Absolutely,
us. Thanks so much.
Brother. Thank you so much.
Good stuff. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, as we are here in Burlington, Iowa. Again, these another one of these moments where, you know, which side are you on? You on the side of corporate greed, or are you on the side of the working people who create the wealth that they pocket? Love to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back on the Working Class Heroes Radio Tour.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1926. That was the day that one of the great labor leaders in U.S. history, Eugene V. Debs, died in Elmhurst, Illinois. In 1894, Debs gained national attention when his American Railway Union launched a boycott in support of the striking workers of the Pullman Palace Car Company. The strike and the boycott were crushed by federal troops and a federal court. Debs served 6 months in jail for his role in the boycott. Later, Debs would again go to jail for standing up for his beliefs. He was convicted for speaking out against U.S. involvement in World War I. He was among the founders of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, in 1905. He ran as a socialist for President of the United States 5 times, receiving nearly 1 million votes running his campaign from a prison cell in 1920. In 1891, Debs wrote an article for the Locomotive Fireman's Magazine titled The Unity of Labor. His words stand as an eloquent case for worker solidarity. Debs wrote, quote, "If working men were united in sympathetic bonds, if a bricklayer could comprehend the fact that he is dependent on the hod carrier, if the locomotive engineer could grasp the fact that he is dependent on the locomotive fireman, the interdependence of labor would at once constitute a bond of union, a chain whose link, forged and fashioned to hold working men in harmonious alliance, would girt them with a defense in every time of trouble and resist invasion, though assailed by all the plutocrats that ever cursed the earth." Deb spent his life trying to bring about this harmonious alliance of working people and standing up for the causes of peace and justice. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Yeah, I'll tell you, Tracy's real. Somebody I would not want to tangle with. But, you know, here's the thing. On the picket line, you know, they organized this great Halloween party. Because, look, you've got to have some kind of normal life. And on the picket line, everyone was dressed up in costumes and, you know, trying to get through what is not a great situation for families, trying to get through this rough time. Because understand, and I keep going back to this and why it's so important to understand how courageous these people are in this moment, because they're not just fighting for themselves. They're fighting for the future. They're fighting for their kids and their grandkids of the future. You know, we met one woman who she's third generation. She's the third generation to work in this plant. So her kids are now working in that plant. This is generationally part of that family's identity. And you know, she said it, you know, I'm not just fighting for myself. My kids have got to work here. What conditions are we going to leave for them? What kind of wages are we going to leave for them? How are they going to get by if we continue to allow concessionary contract after concessionary contract? Now, understand, this is the important part in all this. And the part I don't think most people quite get. Because sadly, only 6% of the private sector workforce is unionized. So most people aren't accustomed to be able to say, you know what? That's not right. Most people are accustomed to what the company imposed this on me. What the company said, this is how it's going to be. Okay, that's how it's going to be. And this is the part that's always been curious to me of why we put up with this. As Americans, we complain about everything, except what happens to us at work. I mean, we complain about things that have nothing to do with us. I have met people who will go on and on about same-sex marriage and about bathrooms and about some theory on race that's critical that is nowhere near them. None of this stuff touches their lives. None of it. And yet, this is what they're consumed by, absolutely consumed by. It's in their every thought, yet the fact that they're not making decent wages, their health care sucks, their retirement security is almost non-existent, and they're told what to do, when to do it, how to do it, where to do it, all of this stuff without any say whatsoever. And that they seem to be okay with. See, this is where my struggle is in all this, folks. This is where I come to this position of, I've been very fortunate. I've always had this kind of mentality that in the workplace, we should have power. Workers should be empowered to make change that's beneficial to them. Because look, the companies are going to look out for themselves. You know that. When there's a downturn, what do? They come hat in hand begging, hey, we need concessions. We need cuts in pay. We need benefits cuts. We need work rules being loosened. We need to cut a bunch of corners so that we can be profitable again to feed our corporate masters, you know, the shareholders and the CEOs. But what about your children? What about your kids' future? What about your family now? What about your retirement security? You know, we're heading into an era right now where there's going to be a retirement tsunami. A lot of people are going to be retiring, and guess what they're not going to have? You can say it because you all know what it is. No retirement. Because what they did, you know, 30 years ago is they eviscerated the defined benefit pension. Most people have no idea. In just a couple of generations, they've completely taken it totally out of our consciousness. The idea that you put in X amount of years into a company, you dedicate your life to building this corporate entity, and that there should be some responsibility to you as a person who actually built the darn thing, that seems to be a foreign concept. And this is where these workers are, I keep coming back to, these folks are courageous. You want to talk about heroes? These are these folks. And they don't want that. They want to go to work. They want to build their product that they take great pride in. They want to support their families. They want to be able to go to the doctor if need be. They want to go to their kids' games. They want a regular life. This is not a fight they wanted. This is not a fight that they asked for. This is a fight that they were pushed into. And like any fight, they're going to win.
They're going to fight to win. Love to hear your thoughts. This is one of those moments where we are all in this together. And I keep coming back to that very simple phrase. An injury to one is an injury to all. And if we don't help these folks now, well, could be us next. Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcasts, you'll find ours. Back after this.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1912. That was the day mill workers began to walk off the job at the Phoenix and Gilbert knitting mills in Little Falls, New York. The strike was sandwiched between the Bread and Roses strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts, and the 1913 Patterson textile strike. American, Hungarian, Polish, and Italian workers, over 70% of them women, struck against wage reductions. Their hours had just been cut from 60 hours a week to 54, and their wages adjusted accordingly. A recent Factory Inspection Commission investigation revealed deplorable working and living conditions, among the worst in the state. As a result, state legislators passed protective legislation restricting women's work hours. Many social reformers pushed for laws like these in the hopes of improving women's quality of life by minimizing their exploitation on the job. But the reduction in hours spelled disaster for these mill women, who then faced a loss of income that ranged between 75 cents and $2 a week. Socialists in nearby Schenectady, including the socialist mayor George Lunn, arrived in town and were promptly arrested for giving open-air speeches in support of the strikers. IWW organizers soon followed to help organize picketing, daily strike parades, and strike committees for each of the factories. They quickly established IWW Local 801, the National Industrial Union of Textile Workers. By the end of the month, mounted police closed in on the women strikers and began clubbing them, many into unconsciousness. The police raided strike headquarters and arrested IWW strike committee leaders. But the women strikers stood strong and were celebrating victory by the end of the year. They won full reinstatement and 60 hours pay for 54 hours work.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Throughout the country, newspaper subscribers are asking questions like, hey, who took my Saturday paper? What happened to those political cartoons and columns that I liked? Why does it take 2 days to get election results and sports scores? How did my local paper get filled with filler? Oh, and who doubled the price of the damn thing? The cause of all the above is a Wall Street concept called financialization, a euphemism for corporate plundering. Multibillion-dollar hedge funds like SoftBank Group, Alden Capital, and Chatham Asset have bought up thousands of our dailies and weeklies. They extract enormous profits not by making a better journalistic product for customers and the community, but by eliminating reporters, selling off each paper's real estate and assets, shriveling and standardizing content, and jacking up the paper's price. Like avaricious airlines, the profit strategy of these Wall Street newspapers is to monopolize the market, then charge more for less. But won't readers stop subscribing? Of course, they're leaving in droves. But hedge fund profiteers don't care, for their plan is to strip mine the business of every dime it has, take the profits, and leave town. For example, SoftBank, the Japanese owner of the Gannett chain, has pillaged hundreds of our local papers and is now making another round of deep cuts in its newsrooms, including dumping some 800 more journalists. The financializers are also requiring other employees to take unpaid leave and are suspending payments to their pensions. SoftBank bosses simply said, "We need to ensure our balance sheet remains strong." This is Jim Hightower saying, sure, take care of number one, but what about ensuring that local journalism remains strong, providing the information and connections that communities must have for strong democracies? But don't be silly, that's not part of the hedge fund business model.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we're spending our day here in Burlington, Iowa, at the UAW Hall, Local 807, talking with the Case New Holland workers who have been on strike for almost 6 months now. And again, I keep coming back to the glaring obvious point here that this is a company that's wildly profitable. And as I said earlier, this is, if you're a shareholder, you've got to be looking at this as corporate malpractice. This is a company that's wildly profitable, put out a high quality product. Now, well, from what we're hearing, not so much. Got to wonder about the profitability. Got to wonder about why they're doing this. And as I said earlier, I think personally it's about union busting. But we'll find out how this plays out. And that's why I've asked Marcus Derby to come talk with us. Marcus is a committee person here with UAW 807, also the local AFL-CIO liaison. Marcus, thanks for taking time for us.
Appreciate you having me on, guys.
So what's the sense here? I mean, you know, you work for Case New Holland. You've worked there for how many years?
I've been there since January of 2012. So I think we're about to go on 11 years now, so just over 10 years.
So you've spent 10, almost 11 years building this company, making them profitable, and this is the treatment. What do you feel? What do you think?
I mean, I think that they're rich enough to, you know, give us a fair contract. You know, today is day 177 that we've been out. Yeah, that's a long time. You know, I feel like we're starting to get starved out now. Holidays are coming in. You know, the fat cat always holds the greedy bag, right? You know, we're sitting out here watching other people take our jobs right now, doing our work. You know, we take pride in what we do. You know, Southeast Iowa is a very strong labor-presenced area. You know, we take pride in what we do here in Southeast Iowa. I think that, you know, I hate to think that maybe we're getting kind of pushed out, you know, on purpose, maybe that, you know, the company doesn't want to have labor in the plant. Maybe it's easier to operate their business without the UAW in there.
Well, it's definitely easier because they can impose whatever they want upon workers. They can do with them with what they want, and they can reap all the benefits and all the profits without ever having to report it. And this is one of those moments where I keep coming back to why having unions are so important. The wealth that our labor creates should be fairly distributed. We should share in the profits of our work. And the sad reality is we're not in that moment right now.
Correct.
So, you know, in looking at where you guys are right now, this is a long strike. How are your coworkers handling this? How are you and your family getting by through this time?
I mean, so this is my second contract that we've been through. So naturally, we were a little bit more prepared, you know, knowing some of the nuances of contract negotiations and the possibility that, you know, we watched our brothers and sisters up north at John Deere, you know, last fall go on strike because they wanted a, you know, a fair contract. They wanted better working conditions. They wanted, you know, better pensions. They wanted better pay. They wanted better benefits. They wanted more job security. And we knew that that was a possibility going into negotiations this time, that, you know, the economy was ripe for the picking. We just came off of, you know, the pandemic where, you know, we had to work, specifically in my area, we had to work through the pandemic as essential workers. You know, we make ag equipment. You know, we made combine headers. So that's corn, bean, and wheat headers. You know, the world can't function without corn, wheat, or beans. You know, so we have a global effect on the economy, and, you know, we had a realistic thought in the back of our head that there's a chance that we could, you know, potentially go on strike. So we knew that there were some sacrifices that we had to make beforehand, you know, save some money back and whatnot.
Yeah, see, here's the thing. I'm looking at some of the proposals, and I don't see anything that you're asking for as outrageous. You know, a small bump in wages, you know, keeping your health care, having a day off occasionally. These don't seem like out of bounds kind of requests. These seem like very basic. Hey, we want to keep a reasonable standard of living, kind of, you know, the kind of American dream job that we've wanted for years. This doesn't seem completely out of bounds. And this is what gets me. I mean, this is a wildly profitable company.
Absolutely. Like, I guess the old saying is, you know, you don't live to work, you work to live. And I guess that's kind of the sentiment, right? For me, I'd like to be able to go to work and work 40 hours a week and be able to come home, spend time with my my kids and be able to go to their basketball games, be able to go to their soccer games, and be able to enjoy that life without having to work exuberant amounts of mandatory overtime week in and week out and not have a choice.
Yeah.
Because we just might need that overtime. We just might need it. And that happens to a lot of folks where, you know, we might need that overtime so they can't, you know, accommodate their life. Well, I got two young children at home. So telling me that in my instance, if I have to work overtime tonight or tomorrow, well, you might need to. Well, I got to tell my daycare provider that I might have to work overtime tonight. Well, say I don't. Well, I still have to pay that person. You know, so that's an extra expense. We need protections in the workplace. And that's kind of another, you know, issue on why we really are struggling in the workplace. It's not just, you know, how rich the company is. It's how we're treated as employees inside of the facility as well. They come out just this past week, you know, in Racine, Wisconsin, they had a replacement worker's van that, you know, they got into an accident. Two of their employees died in that accident. And, you know, they came out with a statement that said, you know, we respect the families and the lives of these employees. Well, where is that respect, though? You know, there's a sign out front of our facility that says, you know, thank you for your hard work and we appreciate our employees. Well, where's our thanks and our appreciation, you know, when we're trying to bargain a fair contract?
No, I hear you.
No, we're not asking for the world.
No, I hear this all the time. We're not trying to make a killing. We're just trying to make a living, just trying to get by. And, you know, this is one of those things, Marcus, where, you know, there are people out there listening. Well, you know, I have to work mandatory overtime. I have to do these things. And this is where I keep coming back to. We've become a country, and I know I'm going to get emails on this because I always do. We've become a country that says, well, since I have to suffer these indignities, well, I have to suffer for paying for my health care and for working for poverty wages in desperate conditions, that everyone should. And when I look at what you're doing and what your coworkers are doing is saying, no, that's not how it should be. We demand better and we're going to fight for better. So for me, the idea of being forced to work mandatory overtime as being now the norm, I'm sorry, I can't swallow that. Because I know that people fought, bled, and died for the eight-hour day,
right,
under the banner of 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will. So if we're working 12, 14, 16 hours a day, what are we giving up? Are we giving up the rest or the what we will? And the reality is, yeah, we're giving up both.
Absolutely. They didn't have sit-down strikes, you know, at Ford in the 30s because they thought that they were getting treated fairly in the workplace. They wanted fair working hours. They wanted better pay. They wanted work standards. We're just reiterating that in 2022. We want those same things. We've finally had enough since the 80s. You know, labor has been on the defensive. Well, we need to stop being on the defensive. It's time to be on the offensive. You look, since 2015, three states have become right to work. You know, you have Wisconsin, Kentucky, and West Virginia. The national labor offensive, we're on the defensive as labor in America. But the more you look at labor in America, you got Amazon, you have Starbucks, you have all of these higher ed university graduate students that are all wanting to be organized because they understand their value in self-worth is more. We're tired of the bullshit.
You listen to the Rick Smith Show here with Marcus Darby. Marcus is a committee person here with UAW 807. He's also a liaison to the AFL-CIO. Now, you hit on an interesting point. Look, I get the passion. I understand the anger. And I hope that anger is being felt by working people across the spectrum. But this strike, this wasn't that kind of anger, was it?
No.
I mean, because there's a movement. I mean, there was Striketober and there was, you know the November strike periods. And we've seen this. But you guys are kind of forced into this. To me, this looks like a company trying to break their union, trying to impose their will, and trying to force you into horrible working conditions and desperation wages.
For sure. We're working 12-hour days in a lot of areas of our facilities. Like I said, we're working a lot of that mandatory overtime. You know, when you put in a 52-hour work week. I know a lot of people, like you said, you're probably going to get emails about that. Well, I have to work those hours. Well, we're working those hours in heavy labor jobs, you know, where we're putting stuff together and proofing it, you know, rubbing our knuckles on bolts, getting oil all over our bodies, you know, bending in non-ergonomic positions. And our working conditions and the safety standards in these types of jobs aren't sitting at a desk. I'm not saying that sitting at a desk is easy, but
there's a difference between sitting behind a desk and lifting 150-pound, you know, hunks of steel.
Right.
I completely understand that. And safety is a huge part of this. So how much of this is that, and how much of this is just, look, we demand a better standard of living. We're going to fight the same fights our grandparents had to fight, you know,
Absolutely.
Generations ago. You know, I had hoped that we wouldn't have to refight these and relitigate the horrible of the past, but it sounds like we're right back in those same situations.
It is definitely standards of living, you know, whether that's pay, that's working conditions, whether that's, you know, benefits, whether it's more time off in the workplace, you know, not having to ask just to go to the doctor's appointment and taking, you know, time off to be able to do that. Where, you know, if we work 4-10s, I have a Friday that I'm not mandatory to work because we have an alternative work schedule that says, hey, you know what, you have Fridays off. Well, I should be able to make my, you know, appointment on a Friday to go to the Veterans Administration Hospital, and I should be able to go to my appointment and not have to go to my supervisor or my HR resource manager and say, hey, you know what? I have to take a vacation day so I can go make my appointment. I shouldn't have to do that. Those types of things. And I'm not the only one. We have 1,200 members between two plants that feel the same way.
And that's why they fight to make the change. So let me ask you this, because I I'm going to get this email because I get it all the time. If you're not happy here, why don't you just go somewhere else?
I could. I choose to stay at CNH because I enjoy what I do. I'm passionate about the quality of work that I create. You know, I said it earlier, we have a global effect on the economy. The stuff we make, you know, feeds every person in the world. And I think that that's awesome. I think that's cool. And some people may not see past the, you know, the color of the paint on a head or the color of the paint on a combine. But what I see is I see more of a vision of, you know what, when I go to the grocery store and I look at a box of cornflakes, you know what, I made the equipment that made that cornflake box possible. That's why I stay where I'm at. I don't go and find another job because it pays more or maybe it has a little bit better benefits. No, it's because I actually enjoy doing the work that I do.
No, that's an excellent answer, much better than the answer I probably would have given, which was simply, why would I want to go somewhere else when I could make it better here? This idea that we're going to go somewhere else to this mythical grass is greener place that might be somewhere else that isn't. The sad reality is if you can't make the place where you are better, there's nothing on the other side. Every job is almost in this same world. I keep hearing people saying, well, I just go somewhere else. Well, somewhere else isn't any better. How about we stand, we fight, we make this the best job it can be? And if we choose to go somewhere else because we want to, maybe we go make that a better place. But ultimately, we should. If this company's as profitable as it is, you should share in that wealth.
For sure.
That seems to me to be kind of the simple answer. So I guess last line of questioning I've got for you in this, because nobody wants this. You didn't want to be on strike, did you?
Absolutely not.
Nobody wants this. I've been on strike in the past. Nobody wins in this. The workers certainly don't win. The company doesn't win. The shareholders who, again, shareholders, if you're listening, if you've got Case New Holland shares, I would be calling the CEO immediately, because you're going to end up losing in all of this because an inferior product is being made right now. And if I'm a customer, I'm not even looking at you. I'm looking somewhere else. So you're damaging the name. But, you know, how do we get this ended, and what's it going to take to get back? And what's the message for the CEOs and the shareholders that are out there?
Just come to the table. Be reasonable. Be rational. I mean, everything that we're asking is not of the moon. You know, we understand it. You know, yeah, you're a lucrative company, but we're also human. We are human. You know, our standard of life is the same as you. I put my shoes on the same way that you do. I wear the same styles of clothes that you do. I eat the same types of foods you do. We all started in the same place, in the elementary schools, the middle schools, and the high schools. That is the fundamentals. We were all raised the same. Now let's just try to become equal and have parity in life. That's all we're asking.
Just a fair shot.
That's it.
Good stuff. Marcus, I appreciate you taking time for me. Thanks so much.
Yep, thank you.
I appreciate the time. Again, Marcus Derby, he is the committee person here at UAW Local 807. Love to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I know some of the angry ones, some of the ugly ones are coming. You'll go to the top of the list. Trust me. I do answer crazy first. Going to take a quick break right back here from the Working Class Heroes Radio Tour. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1983. That was the day that musician Merle Travis died. Known for his unique finger-picking guitar style, Travis wrote songs that captured the hard life of the coal miner. His songs drew from what he had seen growing up in Muhlenberg County, Kentucky. He was born in the town of Rosewood, the son of a coal miner. In 1947, Merle released a four-record set, Folk Songs from the Hills. The album contained the song Dark as a Dungeon, what would become one of his most recognizable songs.
Come and listen, you fellers, so young and so fine, and seek not your fortune in the dark, dreary mines. It will form as a habit and seep in your soul till the stream of your blood is as black as the coal. It's dark as a dungeon and damp as the dew, where danger is double and pleasures are few.
Another song about the life of a miner was this song, titled 9-Pound Hammer.
It's a long way to Harlan, it's a long way to Hazard, just to get a little brew, just to get a little brew. When I'm long gone, just make my tombstone out of number 9 coal. Old number 9 coal.
Perhaps Travis's most famous song was this one, 16 Tons.
Now some people say a man's made out of mud, but a poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood, skin and bones, a mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company
like
store.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we wrap up our time here in Burlington, Iowa, again, we spent most of our time, you know, talking to people around the Case New Holland strike, which I think is an important place to be, a big issue, and something that I think a lot to learn from. You know, like I said at the beginning, in a place like Iowa that is a no-rights-at-work state, you have these workers who courageously have stepped up and said, you know what? We're just not going to take it. And still finding a way to lead normal lives. And on the picket line, you're like, I got a kick out of the Halloween party. And here to share some thoughts as we wrap up on today's events, I've asked our good friend, the producer, the professor, Brett Pransky, to share some thoughts. Brett, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, thoughts?
Well, I tell you what, I have been deeply affected by what I've seen, you know, on the picket lines, both here and at the Ingredion strike previously, because, you know, unlike you with your long history in this kind of stuff, I've never been on a picket line before. These have been firsts for me. So seeing what happens in these, you know, in these environments, and seeing what these folks are fighting for has been quite the experience for me.
You know, in looking at this, and again, you're right. I'm so used to this environment. I guess. You know, what is it that caught you? Me, the courage of being able to walk across that threshold and say, we're going to fight for something better, even if it means we're going to lose our job. The story of the guy, and as I said earlier, Democrats, if you're listening, we need a federal policy. We need a federal law to protect people who have the courage not to scab on someone else's picket line, to not cross a picket line. This should be part of your agenda, and it should have been for a long time. But, you know, And again, that's something shocking, isn't it, Brett?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, that was an incredible story that, you know, there was this one guy who just said, you know what? I work with these people every day. I respect these people. I want to fight for what they're fighting for. And I simply refuse to cross the picket line. It cost him his job. And there he was, you know, out on the line, even though he's not a member, you know, walking the picket line with the UAW folks and showing his support. Even now, it wasn't a one-time thing. It wasn't like he stood up, walked out, and that was the end of his time. He stayed with them, you know, throughout this entire fight. And it's just an incredible thing to see.
And this is where you come back to, you know, and look, I've been on strike in the past, and the management people, you kind of gave them a pass for scabbing on your line because they didn't have a choice. Their management, there's always that kind of tension anyway. But wouldn't it be great if, because look, a lot of the supervisors I knew when we were on strike, they didn't want to cross the line. They didn't want this. If we had the ability to have a federal protection for people to vote their conscience, you know, freedom, liberty, the ability to, you know, I don't know, be respectful to yourself and to your community. I got to wonder how many people would not cross a picket line if given the protection to not.
Yeah, I believe if they were protected and they had the ability to make that choice based solely on what they thought was right, then I think that a significant number of them would have walked at the same time. And to tell you the truth, strike probably already be over.
Again, this is what we absolutely, without question, need to be talking about. Anything else grab your attention in this? I know, you know, because I'm trying to get it from an outsider's perspective. For me, it's like every strike I've been on. These are people who are coming together, regardless of their political differences, their family differences, their personal differences. And in those moments, and why I keep coming back to, the only way we reunite this country, revive and re-energize the working class, is through labor, because these people absolutely united.
Yeah, and I think that I probably, you know, can represent a number of folks out there, because I would imagine that a majority of the people out there in the listening audience are like me, that we may be slightly aware of these things, but we've never actually been, you know, been there in the moment, you know, with the folks, you know, on the line and things like that. So, and I would encourage people to do it. If there is a strike in your local area, I would suggest you go down there, talk to the workers, walk with them for a little while, you know, do what we've been doing, and you'll find that, you know, that they really will welcome you. And I think the closest comparison I've seen to it is probably, you know, since my old school days of playing high school sports, is probably the closest thing to that kind of, you know, team environment, you know, everybody pulling in the same direction, that I've seen since that time.
Yeah. No, and as we've been saying for a very long time on the program, it's time to adopt a striker. We need an adopt a striker program. We need to be doing that, taking on a family and helping them out, because ultimately these folks, they're not getting the wages they were. Their health care has been cut off, except, you know, here, you know, in talking to the Case New Holland folks, the union holds their health care, at least the major medical part of it, not the dental and the eye and all the other stuff. And the stories around that are just heartbreaking. You know, the kids are going back to school and having to pay, you know, $100 for this and $100 for that. And when you have no income coming in, this is a struggle. And the companies know this, which is why they do it, why they push for this. Because I keep coming back to the main reality here. This is the company's responsibility. They did this.
Yeah, they really did. And their behavior this entire time has been, you know, one of an organization that isn't necessarily bargaining, you know, fairly. You know, they're not bargaining in good faith. They're just doing everything they can to, you know, to try to break the strike. And, you know, they're using some means that are, you know, downright cruel when you think about it. And it makes these folks out there, you know, on the line, you know, fighting for their rights. It just makes them that much easier to like and support.
But again, it's another one of these moments. It's another one of these moments where the poor and the working class are pitted against each other, because those people, the scabs coming across the picket line, they're folks who need jobs too. And corporations understand this. They know there are desperate people out there who are going to do desperate things. And crossing someone's picket line is a very desperate thing. But again, it's another one of these moments where the wealthy and the well-connected and our corporate masters, they sure know how to get us to eat our own.
Yeah, I mean, this is what, you know, think about, you know, every time you turn on your TV, you're getting divided in one way or another. You know, left, right, black, white, red, blue, Democrat, Republican. I mean, just over and over and over again. Anytime that there is a way to create a division, you know, somebody pays a lot of money to make sure that division is made. And those divisions are always, always focused on the working class. And that's, you know, because there's so many of us.
Yeah.
If we ever do join together, there's really nothing we can't do. So they got to keep us divided.
Absolutely. But our time here at Case New Holland has come to an end. And like I said, I wish our folks the best. We're going to follow up with them when we get done with the tour. Hope this is short, one day longer, one day stronger, brothers and sisters. Again, if you missed any portion of our program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find yours, you'll find ours. Also, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Tell me what you think, what you know, what you think of what's going on here in Burlington and in Cedar Rapids. Would love to hear it. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.